days.
Auntie Fatima,
I need to know the carats and weight of each item of your jewelry to do a proper calculation.
Well, I'm sure that all my jewelry is 22 carats, and I can use my kitchen scale to weigh it.
Oh no, Auntie Fatima. I think it's better if we take it to a reputable jeweler first. After all, you don't want to underpay, do you?
May Allah bless you. You are always teaching me new things. Shukran.
Pay your zakat. It's the right thing to do.
This message was brought to you by the South African National Zakat Fund. Call 0861-SANZAF at 0861-726-923.
Because charity begins at home.
Assalamu alaikum, listeners. This is Usman Ahmed from Sure Flywild Travel. We have a beautiful 13-night, 14-day package. The first one departs on the 4th of May, returns on the 18th of May. The second one on the 11th of May, returning 25th of May. The third one departing on the 18th of May, returning on the 1st of June. We'll be spending 5 nights at the Sufra Al-Huda in Medina Munawwara with bed and breakfast. And we'll be spending 8 nights at Iman in Makkah Mukarramah, also bed and breakfast. The cost per person sharing two in a room is 11,995 rand per person, three in a room at 10,995 rand per person, and four in a room at 10,495 rand per person. This includes your airfare on Saudi Arabian Airlines out of Joburg, including taxes, twin, triple or quad sharing rooms in Makkah and Medina with breakfast, and your transport between Jeddah, Medina, Makkah back to Jeddah, and your Umrah visa fee as well. For further details, you're welcome to contact Bricks in Pretoria, 012-374-2041, or you're welcome to contact Usman in Cape Town at 021-761-5044.
This is CII. You're listening to The French Connection.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back after that important break, and we're with my guest, Yaakov Zaki, or James Dickey, if you know him on either name. And the fact is, James, you know, these people were very busy in the 1900 to 1908 period in the United States. They forced a terrible depression on the American public intentionally by holding back money supply. And then once that depression came in, they said, see, this is the reason why we need this Federal Reserve Act to be passed. And, of course, they got a tax, income tax, which is unconstitutional, put into law by fiat rather than by acceptance of the public. But so they were very, very busy, these Zionists were very busy in consolidating their control over the new giant being.
So that then is the origin of the Federal Reserve Board, which is the real government of the United States.
That's right. Exactly right. And the only way they could get the Americans to acquiesce to this new group was to put fear into them, as they're doing now. Now they're telling everybody if we don't have a new world currency, then we're all doomed. And it's because they've manipulated the money supply through their private bank. But the same thing happened in the lead up to 1913. So they were very busy consolidating their control over America. And they were also quite busy in Europe, laying the groundwork for the First World War, which they hoped would rewrite the map by destroying the Caliphate, which it did, by destroying the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which it did, by fostering the communist revolution in Russia. And so what they had several ideas that they wanted to get done. You want to talk a little bit about the lead up to the First World War?
Oh yeah, the First World War, I think, to me, is the great turning point in modern history, more so than the Second, which further, of course, consolidated their gains. But until the First World War, there were several very important and powerful, albeit decadent, multinational empires. The Tsarist Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. And the 1918 saw the eclipse of all these, and also the dynasties, because at that point in Germany, which was another empire, there were, I think, 38 states comprised within that empire, some of them kingdoms, other grand duchies. All of this disappeared. Now, I mean, every society is a pyramid. It's all a question of who or what is the capstone of the pyramid. So, in fact, what really happened throughout the 19th century with the rise of capitalism and industry replacing agriculture as the source of the national wealth, more or less everywhere, what happened was that the aristocracy of money replaced the aristocracy of blood. Now, monarchy is the fountainhead of nobility. So when that went, that saw the final eclipse of the aristocracy, who were the last impediment in the way of a Jewish Zionist control of the economies of these countries.
That's exactly the history that I've discovered, and in fact the history that is never taught in our schools, James. And we also know at that same period, they knew there were huge reserves of natural resources in Africa, throughout Africa, but the place they could most easily access it was in South Africa because it was not a jungle or a tropical terrain. They could get their ships in and out of this region quite easily. And so they targeted a group of farmers who had held this land for about 100 years or more, the Dutch Afrikaner, and they went down and said, we know there's diamonds and there's gold and there's bauxite and aluminum and all kinds of things under your soil. So they ran these people off their land, and they did it with Cecil Rhodes and the Round Table. They did it with Oppenheimer and his financial support, and they did it with Rothschild. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Because not many people realize the centrality, the pivotal position of South Africa in this whole global conspiracy, of which Israel is only the tip of an otherwise invisible iceberg. However, South Africa, you're right, it's a geological freak. In its soil, I found some of the most valuable minerals in the world. Minerals that everybody knows about, like gold and diamonds, but as you said, bauxite, other minerals that are essential for the production of steel, and so on. So you can say that whoever controls South Africa controls part of the global economy of the world. Now, to go back to gold and diamonds, it was the discovery of gold under the Afrikaner farms, that is to say in the Transvaal, and of diamonds in Kimberley in the Orange Free State, that are the real background to the South African War.
Yeah.
The South African War was precipitated by Jameson, who was a confrere of Rhodes, and Rhodes was an employee of the Rothschilds. Now, Jameson, who was a criminal and later decorated by the British government, who I think gave him a knighthood, he spent a nominal 18 months in Holloway prison in London for the Jameson raid. But Britain wanted to grab hold of the two Boer republics to the north. They had already driven the Dutch out of the Cape, and they wanted the gold and the diamonds. Or when I say the British wanted it, by that time the Britons were no longer really ruling Britain. What was ruling Britain was the Zionist interest, and they particularly coveted the gold and the diamonds because they needed this wealth to finance the colonization of Palestine, which they had started after 1897. They were sending poor Jews out there to colonize the land, and these people played a role in espionage, working for the British to overthrow Ottoman rule in the First World War. The first move in the South African war was in fact the Jameson raid. Now, the population of the Transvaal and the Orange Free State was pretty sparse. And the one ingredient of it was the Uitlanders. The outlanders or the foreigners, that is to say foreign to the Boers, who were not the people who were not Afrikaners. In other words, they were settlers of Anglo-Saxon descent. Now, they didn't like having to pay taxes to the Boer government in Victoria. So they arranged with Jameson to stage a raid that would take them all the way to Pretoria, the capital. However, Jameson was caught, and the Jameson raid was defeated by President Kruger, and the Kaiser thereupon sent Kur a telegram of congratulation, saying you did it without the help of friendly countries, meaning alluding to himself. Now, this should be of great interest to our Muslim listeners, because it was the Kaiser who opposed around about the same time, at the beginning of the 20th century, although the Jimmison raid is about 1895 to 96, and preceded the South African, the Boer War, by a few years. But it is all part of the same picture, because at the time of the Tangier incident and the Agadir incident, when France, which was by then totally under Zionist control and had been so ever since the famous scandal in the French army a few years earlier, the Dreyfus affair, the affair Dreyfus, which is the great turning point in modern French history, perhaps almost as important as the French Revolution itself. However, France was preparing to take over Morocco and extend her Algerian empire right up to the shores of the Atlantic, backed, of course, by Jewish finance, because it was two Jewish financiers who had paid for the conquest of Algeria, beginning in 1830. After the time of the Tangier incident and the Agadir incident, the Kaiser moved, gave a speech in which he supported the independence of Morocco. But as you know, nevertheless, France in 1912 took over Morocco. Now, the Kaiser, at the same time, who was opposing British interests by constructing a great navy that would be a rival to the Royal Navy, he sent a telegram of congratulation to President Kerr. Now, the Jimmison raid failed, but Jimmison was the close friend of Frank Rhodes, and Frank Rhodes was the brother of Cecil Rhodes, the founder of Rhodesia. And they were all in it together, in fact. It was a conspiracy to get hold of the gold and diamond mineral resources of South Africa, which they finally achieved during the Boer War. And, you know, I mean, ever since that term, ethnic cleansing, became popular around about the time of the Bosnian War, this goes back quite some time. I mean, the Muslims were ethnically cleansed from Spain in 1609 by order of Philip III, and the Afrikaners were ethnically cleansed the way the Plains Indians were ethnically cleansed by the Americans and Manifest Destiny after the Civil War in America. Now, the Boer men were fighting in the veld so that they could be killed off in warfare, but that still left the women and the children. And what the British wanted to do was to eliminate them. So Kitchener invented the concentration camps. Concentration camps are not a German invention, they're a British invention. And all the women, their animals, even their pets, which were destroyed at the entrance to the camp by British soldiers, the women, the children, the cattle were slaughtered so that they could not provide sustenance for the Afrikaner guerrillas. And the women and the children moved into the camps, where the British introduced diseases to which the Afrikaners had no immunity. And the whole idea of this was to strike at the biological root of the Afrikaner nation. Now, why is this historically significant? Because the whole idea here is the same as the idea behind the massacre of Deir Yassin in Palestine in 1948. It was to create an empty landscape that would subsequently be peopled, which in the case of South Africa would mean British people of Anglo-Saxon descent forced to leave their country through poverty. In other words, it was part of the empire in which the sun never sets, because as the world goes round the sun successively lights up a part of the surface of the planet, which is British, which is why the British Empire was always shown as red on political maps.
Well, but you also have to note, too, that during this, just after the Civil War, which the Civil War was being financed through New York money on the North side, as well as being controlled, Jefferson Davis's finance minister was a Rothschild employee before he took over his job as the administrator of the South's finances. So both sides of the Civil War in America that killed tens of millions of Americans, and then after the war, and they got rid of Lincoln, who stood in the way of their complete work, got rid of him because John Wilkes Booth was nothing more than a patsy. There was a Zionist European bent to that murder. Once that happened, Zionism took its real power control movement over the United States, and that's when you see money coming flooding into the United States to support people like Carnegie, like Vanderbilt, and the rest. That was European money in the Rothschild hands and Oppenheimer hands, so that they could use these barons. It wasn't in many cases their own money. The history of Pierpont Morgan and Morgan Stanley shows you that when Pierpont Morgan died, he only had a few million dollars to his name. Everybody thought he was the richest American. All the money he earned and all the money he controlled was actually held by European people, and that was the European trusts were Rothschild and Warburg money. So we know that these people have worked this same sinister crime scam on many people. They did it with the Caliphate. They did it with the Habsburgs in Austro-Hungarian. They did it in Spain. They don't fall far from the tree when they are working this crime. It works well, so why reinvent it? They put their people in top positions as administrators, and then when the right moment comes, they strike and the iron's hot and they take over. And they've done it over and over and over again. They did it in South Africa, but there's always carnage, there's always murder, there's always suffering, and there's always a horrible moral decline after the fact. And we have been subjugated and put into this awful mix over and over again, James. So let's move on now to actually the war and how they were planning to destroy the Caliphate, which they did, in preparation for the depopulation of the Palestinians and the repopulation of Northern European ghettoized Jews out of that region into the so-called Jewish Holy Land, which it is not. It is just a region where many different religions sprung up, but it's certainly not a Jewish exclusive club. So let's talk about that, James.
Well, this is a period of particular interest to me. When the First Zionist Congress took place in Baal, a delegation was dispatched by that Congress, headed by Herzl, to negotiate the purchase of Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire at that time was headed for bankruptcy, and they tried everything. They tried bribery, they tried threats, persuasion. They found that Sultan Abdulhamid was implacable. What he said was, they may cut us up after we are dead, he used the royal plural, but vivisection we will not tolerate. And I've always said that should we ever recover Palestine from its present usurpers, those words should be carved in letters of gold on the walls of Jerusalem. They may cut us up after we are dead, but vivisection we will not tolerate. So because they couldn't move him, and they offered to pull the empire out of bankruptcy because they were prepared to put the whole resources of the Rothschilds at his disposal to recapitalize the Ottoman Empire. But he would not sell out the Palestinians. He said, the Palestinians have fought with us in the Morea, he named three or four theaters of warfare. We will not abandon them now. They may cut us up after we are dead, but vivisection we will not tolerate. So Herzl thereupon went back to report to the next Zionist Congress held in Baal the following year in 1898, and it was decided there and then that they must bring down the Ottoman Empire. Now, at that point, an intrigue commenced set in motion the First World War, in which millions died. Now, we have to understand that the Jewish financiers were backing both sides at this time, but they switched sides at the time of the Balfour Declaration. The background to the Balfour Declaration is very, very interesting. You see, in Britain, there is a close connection between the upper echelons of academia and the British political establishment. In other words, our ruling class, which is pretty corrupt. In fact, I wouldn't call it immoral. It's amoral, because immorality presupposes the existence of morality, and in fact the British ruling class have never known what morality was in order to oppose it. The then foreign minister, he may have been Grey, who was a notorious Germanophobe, but I can't remember which one exactly it was, probably Sir Edward Grey. At the time of the war, wars are waged not just on the front, but also with propaganda. And Britain was saying, those Germans, they are not Democrats. We are fighting for democracy, we are fighting for liberty and all the usual cliches by which people can be persuaded to give up their lives in the interests of the few. The Germans retaliated, saying, you British are a bunch of bloody hypocrites, you prate about democracy, and in fact your number one ally is Tsarist Russia, the greatest autocracy in the whole world. Now, that worried the British, and they thought, what can we do? Germany's ally is the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire persecutes her Armenian subjects. So at that moment, Sir Edward Grey, or whoever was his successor as foreign minister, immediately contacted the vice-chancellor of Oxford University and said, can you point out to me two promising young historians who will write a report on the Armenian massacres? And this was 1915. We're hearing a lot about it today because it's in the papers today in consequence of Barack Obama's speech to the Turkish National Assembly in Ankara.
Yeah.
Well, they, Bryce and Toynbee, whom the Arabs in their naivety mistook for a great friend of the Arabs and of Islam, thereupon set to work to draw up a 600-page report of the Armenian massacres. And the British thought that when this was published, the Armenians in America would use their muscle to bring America into the war on the side of Britain and France, who at that point were on the point of losing. Now, when the report was published, instead of the expected result, it went down like a lead balloon. And the British realized that the Armenians did not have the financial or political influence to bring America into the war. So that is when they approached the Jews and Rothschild, and that is the background, in fact, to the Balfour Declaration. Now, I've been going into this.
We have to mention too, though, James, and I'm going to go on a sidebar here. We know that the Grand Orient Lodge out of Paris seated a new lodge in Italy in the Italian Freemason Lodge, Grand Orient Lodge, was seated. And from there, the Salonica Greece Lodge came from Italy, and that was seated. And all of the people and the participants of the Salonica Greece Lodge were Jews. And the participants, people like Carasso and Jabotinsky, shows up in this lodge.
Ooh, Jabotinsky, the most violent of all the Zionists. Yeah,
that's right. He shows up, and he's working both the planning for the Russian implosion and the Russian Revolution, and he was also working for the Ottoman Revolution at the very same time. But we also know that the Turks had already been infiltrated by this Young Turk movement, who were converts under Sabbatai he had put the idea that you could claim to be Islam, but to actually secretly hold on to your Sabbatean roots, these Young Turks were working as administrators. They were very high placed in the government because they seemed to have access to the right power, the right money, and as the Ottoman Empire was finding itself in financial trouble, these people's popularity and power grew at that time. So this was a setup on many fronts, and a lot of people don't note that the Freemason lodges that had been taken over by Judaism, specifically the Orient lodges, were very big players clandestinely in the Ottoman implosion and the Young Turk movement, which precipitated the murder of the Armenians.
Well, it was Salonika that was the headquarters of this conspiracy. It was the 9th Army Corps of Salonika that marched in Istanbul in order to dethrone the Sultan in 1908. And that's when Sultan Abdulhamid was dethroned. And he was put under house arrest in the house of a Jew in Salonika.
Right.
And that was financed, because all revolutions cost money, including coup d'etat, that was financed by the mayor of Rome, who was the chief Freemason in Italy. So there you've got the link. Italy and Salonika.
Okay, that's where Carrasco came in. He was working between the two lodges. Carrasco, and in fact, you want to hear this? You know who was the first person to build the Orient Lodge in Italy was none other than the brother of Napoleon Bonaparte.
I have heard that the Napoleonic claimants to the French throne are in fact Freemasons.
Well, that's right. Now,
Napoleon wasn't himself. As you know, Napoleon converted or contemplated converting to Islam in Egypt, and the third French governor of Egypt was in fact a convert to Islam who married an Egyptian aristocrat. The first was Napoleon, the second was Kleber, the third one, the convert, I've forgotten his name. But I have heard that the present heirs of Napoleon are all Masonic. Hmm?
Well, now we can get into this. This is interesting because the person who they decided was going to become prominent in this overthrow and ultimately took over the Turkish part of the government, of this government as it was in destruction, was, of course, Ataturk, who was Jewish, and he came from Salonika. But we also can note that the British tried to invade, and, of course, what they did was they set up a massacre against British troops in order to help hatred against the Islamic and Muslims of the Ottomans in Gallipoli. Of course, that was a failure on every front. Nobody it was one of the worst defeats British army ever suffered. And of course, it turned this Jewish new leader, this new secular leader of Turkey, into a hero. And then, of course, he became an autocrat and a despot. And of course, he oversaw the dismantling during the war of the Ottoman Turk Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, when you see the names and the people. But here's the interesting thing that many people don't know. One of the main families in Salonika, Greece, at this time was none other than Nicolas Sarkozy's grandfather.
Yes. Well, Sarkozy is no more a Frenchman than I am.
Well, no, he's a Zionist Jew, and the fact is his grandfather was, his family, his grandfather moved to Paris after the fact, but during this period, his great-grandfather and grandfather's family was very prominent rabbis in that community, so they played a very huge part in the Zionist takeover of the Ottoman Empire. And again, now he's placed, not surprisingly, in a leadership role, and they keep vaulting him into new positions.
He's half Salonican and half Hungarian and 0% French.
That's right. You're exactly right.
Can I read you a passage from my new book, which is still not published, but may throw light on this? I mean, everybody knows about Sykes-Picot, because the Middle East is still ruled under the Sykes-Picot system, which dates from 1916. So whilst the rest of the world has moved on from there, the Middle East remains frozen at that moment in time, with all the Sykes-Picot borders and vested interests intact. I'll begin reading this paragraph, and you'll find that it dovetails with much of what you have been saying. And I'm talking about Sir Mark Sykes.
And it said, Sykes' story is instructive as showing how the interests of Zionism and Arab nationalism coincide in the overthrow of the caliphate, met in a sinister conjunction whose baleful aspect presaged disaster for all Muslims. How many Arabs know that the flag used in the Arab revolt was designed by the Zionist, that's the Sykes himself? Now again, how many Arabs realize that the flag that Nasser substituted for the old Egyptian flag, which Egyptians regret because they say it was the most beautiful flag in the world, is in fact based on the flag that Sykes designed for the Sharif Hussein to lead the Arab revolt? And the flag of the Emirates in the Gulf is the same. The flag of Jordan, the same. The flag of Iraq, the same. The flag of Syria, the same. They all incorporate the same combination of colors. Anyway, to go on from this, in all this, Sykes was closely involved with Kitchener, whom he had known since they campaigned together in the South African War. A Yorkshireman, Sykes served with the Yorkshire Militia from 1902, guarding the British lines of communication, constantly menaced by Boer guerrillas. In 1905, he was sent to Turkey. He availed the opportunity to revisit Syria and Iraq, in both of which places he employed his time doing mapping for the Warren Office, which means that the British had planned the First World War 10 years before it broke out. 2 years later, he returned and entered politics, for which he had a natural aptitude, having discovered a talent for acting while she had a student. You know that the closest of all professions to politics is the stage.
Yes, right.
But it was in the convoluted tribal politics of the Middle East that Sykes found the ideal métier for the exercise of his warped instincts. The Sykes-Picot agreement has to be seen against the background of Franco-British differences during a critical phase of World War I. Sykes had been heavily involved in Serbia and Bulgaria till 1915, when his familiarity with the Ottoman terrain, he wrote 4 books on the subject, led to his being elected for some delicate negotiations with the French. Circumstances had soured the Entente Cordiale. The French, observing the Dardanelles fiasco, were growing increasingly disillusioned with their British allies. Moreover, deeply suspicious of British intentions in the Levant, they were getting restive and had to be cajoled. Sykes' flawless French and Jesuit education commended him for the task. Sykes was given the job of smoothing them down by exerting his notorious charm on Georges Picot. Georges Picot, the French foreign minister during the First World War, to ensure that the Entente continued to be cordial. It was at this moment the Arabs lost Palestine. Although the British were disposed to relinquish Lebanon to the French, Syria proper had to be retained if the Sharif Hussein were to be induced to enter the war. But at the same time, Palestine had to be detached from the Syrian question as a bait, because Palestine is the southernmost of the 5 provinces of Syria. Palestine had to be detached from the Syrian question as a bait, so the Jews would exert leverage on the United States to bring the Americans into the war on the side of Britain. Though Balfour gets the credit, the real architect of the Balfour Declaration was the rather obscure figure of James Malcolm, a Whitehall mandarin pulling, after the manner of his kind, the strings behind the scene. There
well,
you are.
You know, and it's interesting when we take a look at this, it's not all Jews involved. We have non-Jews involved in this for their own personal interests or their own profiting interests. So you can see it with Cecil Rhodes. You can see it with this Malcolm guy. We see it a lot. But what we always see is at the top, the people sitting in the boardrooms, the people sitting in the banking structure are exclusively Jewish, and they're exclusively from this Talmudic school of Zionism. So what we need to understand here is we have to clarify facts here, James, because a lot of people will point out the fact that history is full of non-Jews' involvement. Well, that's true. But if you get to the top, again, the capstone, as you pointed out, and you go right to the top where the financing is being done, You'll know that the people are exclusively Jewish. Now, this is also true when you see the two-sided financing of many of these wars. We can see it in World War II through I.B. Farben being financed by Jewish money. But I.B. Farben, of course, is also being controlled by Hitler's people. So how can the money come from Jewish interests being run by Hitler? And he knows where the money's coming from. He knows it's coming from New York City Jews, Harriman and the rest. So the fact is that these people are always working both sides. They always have, just like they did in the Napoleonic Wars. Mm-hmm. And this is an MO, a modus operandi, if you will.
Yeah. In the American Civil War. Yeah.
Because the American Civil War.
The finance minister of the Confederacy was Jewish.
That's right. That's right.
But basically, I think the result of the Civil War was a disaster, not just for the America, but for the whole world, because it meant the triumph of capitalism, the triumph of industry over the South with its aristocratic instincts that go with an agrarian economy.
Well, you know, but interesting, though, when we see the availability of capital in the concentrated hands of Jews, we always know that crony capitalism is a bad idea. And I got to say, non-crony capitalism, which the world has never known, we've never experienced it because it's never been allowed to flourish, is not a bad idea. To allow people who want to help a good idea come into the marketplace for a small or a large profit, it gives them motivation to bring good things to marketplace. But that has never, ever been the case in capitalism. Capitalism has always been controlled, and we've never had a free-moving discovery process. And you can see that with the Whittle engine. You can see it with batteries that could have saved us, not using fossil fuels. Or you can see it back when Goodyear. Goodyear tire company.
The tire people, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They bought all the trolleys off with General Motors out of Los Angeles, so people had no public transport, and forced them to have cars, so that they'd sell rubber and they would sell vehicles. I mean, this kind of stuff is not capitalism. What this is despotic crony capitalism, which has destroyed our planet. And it's in the hands of these money men and these Zionist criminals, and has always been.
Yeah, I think that.